Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply. Oh, hi there, Super Ninfriendos. It's episode 613 of Nintendo Voice Chat Podcast. I'm your host from the great state of Maine, Seth Macy. I'm joined here by Per Schneider, direct from the office.
Hello, yeah, I'm in the Metal Gear Solid facility here. That's what it looks like behind me.
Metal Gear?
But, the studio is occupied. I couldn't come to your seat.
It does look like that.
No, the studio is being used for Daily Fix or Summer of Gaming or something.
God, well, I got a lot of nerve. From the Casey Drome, Casey DeFritis.
Hello. What's up, everyone?
Man, Casey has her own drone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't know that?
Cool. No, that's really cool.
I don't know what drone means, but I'll just rail with it.
I don't either. And it's like from the Pinball Museum in sunny Las Vegas, Sam Claiborne.
Yeah, right. I'm not in Las Vegas, for the record there, but there is a pinball museum in Las Vegas.
It's true.
I'm just in my garage in here, Humble, California.
Right. It's just a little miniature version of a pinball. It's your own personal pinball.
We have a pinball museum in Alameda here, and that's a island off of Oakland. It's really lovely. It's called the Lucky Juju Pinball Museum.
That's also where the naval base is, where Chekhov looks for the nuclear vessels.
That's exactly right, and where Mythbusters blew up everything on the tarmac. Right.
Really?
Yeah. Every time they blew up something, it was like that giant driveway. Yeah. Big tarmac slab. That was the old Alameda runways.
Oh, that- seeing the aircraft carrier is really fun to visit, by the way. It's really
cool. It's really cool. Yeah, and the city is amazing from there. Like the San Francisco skyline and the bridges and everything. It's just a really cool area. And Casey used to live on an island out in the bay as well.
I did. Out in the middle of nowhere. I got to see it all.
And that was made as an airport. That was going to be the San Francisco International Airport.
Oh, it was an artificial island.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like a big square. And you know what's on that island is the Indiana Jones scene that's set in Germany where they burn all the books. That is one of the World's Fair buildings on that island, and it's like it's unmistakable. You just go, and it's like that. It has like a little drive up where the car pulls around, you know, because you know Lucasfilm is Bay Area. Anyway,
yeah,
there's our Bay Area speak for this week, but it's a diversion from Maine, right?
Right.
A lot of
I used to live. That's so funny.
Apocalyptic scenes are filmed on Treasure Island by like indie filmmakers in the area.
Wait, it's called Treasure Island?
Yeah, it's called Treasure Island. Yeah, it's attached to Yerba Buena, which has the bridges that go over it, and then there's like a flat area called Treasure Island. We basically live in a Grand Theft Auto game. Like, it is the funniest set of environments here. And you know, so Alcatraz is right next to it, for example.
I live across the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin, which is basically the forest moon of Endor. That's where a lot of the scenes up in Marin were shot. That's where, obviously, Skywalker Ranch and everything was, too.
And the sea facility from Star Trek III is there. They say it's in Monterey, but they filmed that naval or the Marine Institute in there. And a lot of scenes are shot there.
I think you mean the Cetacean Institute?
Yes, the Cetacean Institute.
It's also where Starfleet is, if you watch any of the shows.
Every time, even the new series.
Who can forget that San Francisco? San Francisco.
Yeah, but they always say San Francisco, and then they always show the other side of the bridge, which is not San Francisco. It's not even the same county.
Nope.
Well, we don't know what the 23rd century holds.
Yeah, perhaps could be San Francisco. Some city limits changing.
You know what? Let's talk about video games.
After the eugenics wars?
All right, let's talk about video games, because I was just reading, like, unhappy comments from people who are like, they were talking about a mouse in his house.
Did we start the episode?
Yeah, we're deep into this episode. There's no going back.
Mario Zelda Metroid. Folks.
This is how we get to know one another. You get to know each member of the panel and what artificial island they live on or may have lived on at one point. So it's awesome. I like that kind of stuff. But let's go right into video games. No Man's Sky developer Hello Games said they are putting the, quote, finishing touches on the Nintendo Switch version. And this will be a complete version of No Man's Sky, unlike the one that was launched originally, with all 20 major updates. Now, I don't know if anybody on the panel has played No Man's Sky since its release.
I played the heck out of it, but only at release.
Oh, all right.
And also, I thought it was pronounced Nomansky.
Yes, well, it's
Sam.
It depends on which coast you live on, actually.
Nice. Sam with a zinger for floor guy there. No Man's Sky, I played it after most of the major updates, and I don't usually stick with it because it's obviously a very time consuming involved game, but it's pretty impressive how, you know, it just keeps on expanding, and it gets closer to the vision that when we saw the first trailers, we thought that was what the game was going to be right off the bat, and it's just taking a little longer to get there, but it's just such a really it's such an impressive game, just the scope of what you can do in here.
This game was being announced and all that hype period, of course everybody fell for it, but my oldest son was just this he wanted nothing more than to play No Man's Sky, so we got it for I think PlayStation 4, and he played it for maybe 2 hours at launch and was like, not for me.
No, it's because sometimes I love games, most of the times, I love games where planets, lands, countries, dungeons are thoroughly designed by a game designer, leading you down a path, creating puzzles and challenges for you, where randomly constructed games just can't compete. That said, you cannot design a universe of the size of No Man's Sky, right? And so when I first started playing No Man's Sky, I really loved all the concepts, gathering resources, taking off from a planet and going into space and then going down to another planet. Just that never got old. All of that was good, but you just ran out of unique things to do, and there weren't enough random encounters. And since then, the game has added just a ton of stuff, from building a homestead to encounters in space and convoys and all that. And it just gets better and better. And so I will definitely check back in again.
Yeah, I remember several years ago, probably at the lowest point for No Man's Sky, on a Steam sale, it was $4.99. And I was like,
Oh, wow.
Nah. And now the lowest it ever gets is $30 because I played it on bingo cards. We're going to mention Game Pass. I played it on Game Pass, which I believe it's still on. And I kind of fell in love with modern No Man's Sky. It's everything that I look for in a game, which, of course, I famously like just love open world. Well, this is open universe. Yeah. And it does. It feels alive. And I love going to space
stations. You like flight stuff, too. So there's a lot of flight stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of flight stuff. It's not quite as simmy as I
No,
as
how
I
could
prefer.
It be?
Well, yeah. That
no,
is
but true. The I think the one flaw that kept me from playing it longer in the beginning was that it didn't offer a cooperative multiplayer experience. And that was something, you know, that caught my attention from the beginning, because it was announced and then the multiplayer turned into something very, very different that people made fun of. But like, if you play, there's a game called Deep Rock Galactic, which is all about mining space planets and going deep into mines and encountering robots and creatures and all of that stuff. And that one is designed for four-player collaborative multiplayer. And like, if No Man's Sky had launched like that, I think I would have kept on playing it just with my kids for ages.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to get this on Nintendo Switch, because I don't trust that it'll run that great.
I was going to say that as well. So they were working on this secretly for a little over 2 years, and the developers have straight up said that there were times where they thought this would be impossible, because this is a procedurally generated game. Mm-hmm. Everything is created by the system that it is on. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of power, which the Nintendo Switch lacks. I'm sorry. I love the Nintendo Switch. I choose to play games on it 90% of the time.
You don't have to apologize.
The
truth is the truth.
But it is the truth. I've also played a little bit of No Man's Sky and seen it just from PS4 Pro to its performance on the PS5. And that jump, like, none of my friends that have the option to play on a PS5 or an Xbox Series X ever want to go back to playing on just like the pro versions of the systems, the generation before. So how is it going to go? How is it going to play on the Switch if they have had the option to play it on one of the newer systems as well? A little bit concerning. And also, I couldn't find, I'm just assuming this is not the case, so I could not find anywhere if there's going to be cross-play or cross-save for the Switch. I'm assuming not.
Ooh. Yeah, that seems kind of critical. I wonder if they're going to use
people
any...
who only have the Switch, well, I hope it's wonderful and great and completely worth it.
Yeah.
It's a good, like Switch game because of its, like, just kind of passive nature, like for a plane flight or for, you know, sitting back and playing. Like, it is a good match, but I totally see what you're saying about it. Yeah, exactly. I love No Man's Sky's launch. I played it for hours and hours and hours, and I actually got less interested in it when it was modified and changed and everything. And now I'm very interested in going back now that it's at a state of completion, because like it was just like, I was like, okay, since I like the finished quote unquote version of it that I was playing, I was like, well, I don't want to like have a bunch of changes and like things pulled out from under me while I had like built up like the thing that I was building. Like I really liked what I was doing in that game. Anyway, now I'm interested in playing it, but I have this like fantasy that I'll go in and play it and port my save over, and like I'll have some huge advantage because I played so much early on and I got like closer to the Galactic Center, like whatever. But I know that's probably not the case.
It's a really good, I actually think it's a really good handheld game. Granted, I'm hoping it runs all right and looks all right on Switch in the end, but it's a great couch game while you're watching TV, because there are a lot of tasks that you do, right? Like just mining or constructing or exploring, flying around, that you can do while you're paying attention to a storyline in a TV show. So it's not a game that commands your attention where you're constantly talking to characters and listening to story stuff. Look, if you've never played it and you've been wondering what the fuss is all about, I think it is now a good game.
Yeah,
is it fantastic?
Agree.
No, not yet.
Yeah, it's definitely not a 10 masterpiece.
Nope.
I am very, okay. very fond of it, though. And like you're saying, if you haven't played it yet, and like Casey was saying, if you only have a Switch and you're interested, like, absolutely.
What's cool is that it'll wow you from the beginning a lot. Yeah. Like, there's a lot, because you get used to its permutations, and that's when it kind of gets a little dull. But, like, when you're surprised the first few times, it's awesome. And, like, it feels really big and vast, and then it's just like, okay, well, the algorithms are a little bit limited because that's just where technology is today.
Right. Yeah, I treat every planet like I do with Minecraft, where I'll spend, 3 or 4 hours building I find the perfect spot, and I'll build the most amazing, settlement there, and I'll have my cows and my pigs and my sheep, and I'm like, okay, I'm bored. And I'll just, in Minecraft, I'll just get in a boat and go across the ocean until, I hit something. Or in No Man's Sky, I'll just fly to the next planet and find another one and do it all over again. I'm a very predictable human being.
You do the Mary Poppins. You're like, whenever you're done with that family, you go, I'm out of here.
Yep.
I love flying over the planet and looking for resources. It's just fun for me. I could just do that forever. A lot of people just get really bored with that, but I loved it. I think that's what I like about that game.
Yeah, cool. It's simple, fun little stuff to do, and it's nothing. I'll say this: it can be as challenging as you want it to be. I haven't played in a while, but I remember finding an abandoned space freighter and going in there and being like, "Oh my god, this is like Dead Space Light." It was kind of creepy, and there's traps and things of that nature, and I get to explore and find all these really cool things. I didn't have to do that if I didn't want to. I could have just flown right by. And instead, curiosity got the best of me, and I found this incredible section of the game that I didn't even know existed up until that point. So, yeah, if you have a Switch and you're interested in checking it out, check it out. And I'm on the fence. If it sounds like it runs well, if there's some sort of cloud streaming, I'll probably pick it up, especially if there's a physical edition. I'm a sucker for
I know that's edition, a good point so.
Yeah, cool. So there it is, coming soon.
Soon.
Yeah,
finishing they said summer.
June.
Coming summer. In summer. Yeah,
July.
Okay,
June
or August even. All the I guess we'll September
get, mobile will get a release date for Summer of Gaming.
Yeah. Ooh. or Australian summer, December.
Oh. No, that doesn't, that's, they're all backwards and upside down over there. Do you know hamburgers eat people in Rand McNally? That's a Simpsons reference. All right.
I like
this year. I decided I actually wanted to follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals. So I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener. I went to watch it and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN. It's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. That's NordVPN.com/NintendoVC, Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
We had an update from E3, the big thing that we used to all get excited about every year, and the Nintendo was there, and like a Miyamoto
comes from
a parachute with a fan on his back every year. It was very exciting. There's no
other Simpsons reference.
That's a Simpsons reference, but it's also a reference to real life. There was the fan man who got the crap beat out of him, I think by Mike Tyson, for landing in the middle of a title fight in an open stadium, and the two boxers just pugilized him ruthlessly. So anyway, E3 is coming back. It's back. 2023. Yeah, it's back next year, but I'm pretty sure they said that last year. But they gave us a statement. They said, quote, "We will devote all of our energy and resources to delivering a revitalized physical and digital E3 experience next summer. Whether enjoyed from the show floor or your favorite devices, the 2023 showcase will bring the community, media, and industry back together in an all-new format and interactive experience. We look forward to presenting E3 to fans around the world live from Los Angeles in 2023. There it is, 100% coming back. I said many, many times, E3 is never coming back, and apparently I was wrong. But I'm interested to hear what your takes are. Is it really coming back? Sam, what do you think?
Well, my favorite device is the original Game Boy, so I'm looking forward to experiencing E3 on my favorite device.
Oh, yeah.
A 160 dot matrix display with stereo sound. And very, very uncomfortable headphones. Monkeypox permitting, it'll be great to have a in-person, you know, world event to look forward to. But there's some issues here. I mean, E3's participation has been, you know, waning. The companies that participate in E3, and so I don't know if the ESA is going to be wooing, companies like Sony back. Well, this would be what it's nice for Nintendo fans is that Nintendo does participate, and they usually come out swinging, right? It's like a marketing beat for Nintendo, as they say in the industry. That's always has big stuff, and now they will have like weird times of year where they have a direct with amazing announcements. But E3 is always the guarantee that there's going to be cool stuff, and it's something to look forward to in the summer, and I think that's important to look forward to.
I think, obviously I've been at E3 for more than 2 decades. I've gone to many, many events. I've talked to many people at the ESA. You know, when E3 was canceled, we actually pitched to the ESA that IGN could run an online version of it. So lots of conversations. I do believe it's coming back next year. And what you said, it may be true that a lot of the major publishers are saying we don't really need an event where, you know, to be on the show floor at E3, these publishers in some cases had to pay multiple millions of dollars for their booth spaces and constructions, right? The ESA is a nonprofit organization of all the game companies. And, you know, even if they don't participate, Microsoft, Nintendo, they're still part of the ESA.
What the E3 could turn into is a hybrid between a public event and a publisher event. And yeah, maybe Microsoft won't be there or Sony won't be there because those companies believe that they themselves have so much clout that they can put on either physical or digital events that get a lot of people to watch and come. But I would say beware preaching to your choir, because what happens at E3 is it creates this groundswell of excitement and interest. And I do think people who own a PlayStation may watch Nintendo conferences, or, yep, you know, people who may not be into Ubisoft games will watch Ubisoft because it's an event sandwiched in between their favorite Call of Duty reveal or something else. And so
exactly,
I do tremendous value to that. From press perspective, there was always value in being in a place, being able to sample games so that it's not just us passing along what we saw in a non-interactive trailer to the audience, but actually being able to say, hey, this is looking good, or this is not looking so good. And being able to instantly ask questions, right? Like it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to generate stories and knowledge that we would share then for weeks to come on shows like NVC. And I'm always sad when people on social media go, good riddance, we don't need E3. It's like, no, you don't need it. But something is really lost when there isn't an event that brings people together like that.
There's a funny little, you know, bit of background to why E3 exists and why consumer facing electronic shows like the CES show also exist. And that's that originally that timing was there so game stores, like physical box games, people could go, you know, and look at all the stuff and then make decisions for the fall season, you know, and make inventory decisions. Like, we're gonna, you know, well, we're gonna get, you know, a ton of these Sonic 3 cartridges. Like, this is gonna be big. Like, that's a really cool origin of E3. And the fact that the press could be involved in that, it's similar to Sundance, right? Where it's like, there's a reason that Sundance exists. Yep. It's not just for critics, it's for other purposes, but the critics are a huge part of it. So the journalistic side that we provide gets to participate and see all those things and evaluate them in the same way that we're still evaluating them, just like a GameStop CEO would, right? But we get to make content out of that instead of making buy decisions. I love that origin of E3, but that is also, what did I just explain to you? It's like a completely dead reason. Like, there's no reason that E3 should exist for that anymore. So they've had to, like, think about, like, well, what is E3's reason to exist? If it's just to have our games, you know, in front of critics, and that's not really enough. So they want to put them in front of fans more. That's, like, a big thing, and, like, make it a public event and stuff like that. So you can kind of see, like, why does E3 need to exist? Like, that reason isn't really clear. But from our perspective, we love it. We want it to exist so bad.
Yeah.
And so there just needs to be a good business reason for the ESA to make it exist.
There's also part of E3 that I think the public doesn't see, and that's the second floor of every booth. Nintendo's booth is a show floor of stations where you can play games, they make them look really cool by having, you know, statues of your favorite characters. All of that spectacle is really good at drawing you in. You're also observing player feedback. You can see if people are having fun, and you're as a journalist, you're learning something from the experience others have with these games. But the second floor of the booth is all meeting rooms, and these companies, it's very rare that this much talent is together in one hall or multiple halls. You know, it happens a bit at Gamescom, but it is a little bit more European company heavy. And what happens is all these game studio leads are there, and new partnerships are being forged, check-ins are being made. And sometimes, you know, in the case of companies like Nintendo or Sony, local teams from the US, that is one of the few opportunities where their leaders are meeting with top brass from the Japanese studios. And so I wouldn't discount that as well.
Casey, I'd like to hear your thoughts on E3.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think for most Nintendo fans, there's not a huge difference. I mean, Nintendo continued with the same sort of caliber presentations for June for the last 2 years. I mean, 2020, they were probably already finalizing what they were planning to present, so that probably didn't change that much. But last year, I feel like it wasn't that much different of an experience, except for the things that Pear mentioned. We have not been able to go hands-on, so there are games that may have been elevated that didn't get the chance to because more people didn't have access to it. And what I mean is, like, indie games or indie games that might have flown under the radar that we may have not thought to talk more about unless we had the opportunity to play it, which happens on the show floor at events like E3 and Gamescom. I know there were so many games that I went hands-on with at these sort of events that I would then keep track of and watch and wait, and just seeing a trailer doesn't do a lot of those games justice because there are so many of them. So I feel like it's a lot more difficult to elevate games when you're not actively being able to play all of them yourself as well. And as same thing as Pear said, I think it wouldn't change a lot for Nintendo fans, but maybe for fans who wouldn't necessarily have watched Nintendo's presentation, but will just because it's part of the E3 programming, and that does change and make a difference. And it's the same thing. I watch things that I wouldn't necessarily watch just because it is part of the programming, because it's an event and it's a thing and you want to know everything that happens. And without that one overarching tag to kind of bring everything together, personally, I get a lot more checked out. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I watch every one of the major conferences, whether I am that interested or not. And
yeah, you're required to. So,
well, mm-hmm. also it's a requirement.
No, but I totally get it. Yeah, I did before I worked here.
Yeah, before I worked here, I made my decision on whether I was going to buy an Xbox One or mm-hmm. a PS4 from watching E3 live streaming, probably on IGN. And when they said that the PlayStation 4 was $399, I said, "Well, that's the one I'm going to pre-order right now." But I've only been to the one E3. I went to E3 2008. That's where Shigeru Miyamoto jumped out of a closet in front of me. That's where I almost ran into Andrew WK and ended up ruining a shot that he was doing for something I didn't realize. It was an amazing.
Did you give him a bloody nose?
Dude, this is what happened. I was like looking at my phone and I looked up and Andrew WK was like right there. Like, he's a giant man. And I swore like extremely loudly. I went, "Holy, it's Andrew WK," as loud as possible. And he looked away.
They love that.
And then I realized he was looking at a producer and there was a camera and they were doing a take for some thing. And I just had completely ruined his take. And I felt kind of embarrassed, but also completely geeked out because I love Andrew WK so much. I was like, "Oh, I love you, man. I just think you're really inspirational." And he's like, "Oh, yeah." And just walked away and reshot his take. And I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, yes, I remember now. E3 was such a magical experience. And you've all mentioned that maybe the public should have more of a role in E3. And I even wrote a feature about this. And I 100% agree. Like, I think it should just be a public thing. And I say that because they allow, 5,000 people to have public tickets? Some, you know, very small amount. And I happened to be walking by the entrance at the exact moment when they let the public in. And there's this one dude and he like ran in and he fell to his knees. He's like, "Ah," like a lifelong dream had been achieved. He was the first guy in E3 on public day. And I was like, "Man, that guy just gets it. That's what this needs." And I'm the same way on the social media when people are just like, "Oh, gross E3. It's like, come on.
Gamescom has proven the model, right? Like, Gamescom, 300,000 people from across Europe come to this event every year. Obviously, you know, it was digital last year as well. This year, it's back to be in physical form, smaller, but we're still talking over 100,000 people coming there, even in a downscaled one. It's like, they can't fit more people. Gamers want to come and play these games. Yes. And have fun with their friends. And, you know, what's so notable about Gamescom is that it's not just about the new announcements and the games you've never played before. There are lots of games on display that are actually out and people play them because it's like Disneyland for them, you know.
Yeah.
It's enjoying it with their friends. So there's definitely something to that public thing. But yeah, you brought up the celebrity angle, which is really interesting because there are a lot of celebs and lots of folks from Hollywood who show up for E3 because they want to, you know, and lots of athletes too, because they're into video games. And this is like a place where they can see them for the first time as well. And like the story, I don't know if we've ever told this publicly, but almost 20 years ago, we snuck Leonardo DiCaprio into E3. With an IGN badge and a fake he had a fake beard and a hat on. And like there are so many people who are getting their first looks at games, and then you get also attendees of the show get their first look at celebrities they've never seen before.
Yeah. Actually, go on Twitter and search for Zach Ryan, search Miyamoto plus Kanye to read one of the most unbelievable stories. It has nothing to do with E3. No, it was E3. But
yeah, it was E3.
I don't want to ruin, that's his story to tell. But Casey, what were you going to say?
What was I going to say? Oh, this is probably completely unreasonable, but it would be great.
There's no rules here. This is NBC.
I mean, it would be unreasonable to ask the companies on the show putting things onto the show floor, because things cost money, but to extend it into the for the public, have like the weekdays for press, and then have the weekends as well, and also some overlap days, and so everyone has plenty of time and it's not overly crowded in a rush.
I honestly think one press day is enough. That's how Gamescom is. It's not as the press, you cannot observe games being played or have meetings on the public day. It's more difficult to jump in line and play games, obviously, because there's so many people waiting to play. But come on.
PAX
one press day, two public days would be awesome.
Yeah, PAX has press hour and a half. So it's because it's a fan-focused show.
Different show,
PAX is very fun as a fan, by the way. Highly recommend.
PAX is fun. Getting into E3 early is like a cool thing to do. It's just like fun to see everything getting set up. Casey reminded me of a point. She was talking about how it's hard to champion games without playing them. It's also, there's a flip side of that where, let me use Kirby as an example, the recent Kirby game. Like, the speculation about that game, about it being a Mario Odyssey-like, or an open world, or like, you know, some like interesting expansion of Kirby, like, that would have all like not have happened, because we would have known what Kirby was because we would have played it. But Nintendo like was very quiet and mysterious about that game and showed trailers that did not convey what that game was. So, you know, it would have been interesting to see how that would have played out with, you know, reporting on it, which we didn't get to do until we previewed it, which was way closer to launch.
Or two, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that type of stuff is, you know, it shows you the role of previewing objective criticism and, you know, versus just marketing, where, like, you know, it's like they don't want you to, this game is necessarily a thing like, oh, this could be this awesome big game I'm getting really excited about. They're just gonna let that happen.
Yeah. Right. I know a lot of people still thought it was an open world game even after it had come out.
It's like a trick.
Yeah, I like streamed it. The preview embargo when the demo came out, and people were like, so many people are asking, like, so this is an open world game, right? And it's like, no, it's not.
No, not so much. E3 would have solved that and many other problems. So I'm hoping that E3 is officially going to come back, and I hope they do lean into the fan angle. And I really hope I get to go to E3, because E3 2018 was one of the funnest like 3 days or whatever that I've ever had in the game industry.
2018, huh?
Yeah, 2018. I'd been IGN for 2 months. And I went to E3.
What was Nintendo's booth? Was that the Odyssey year?
It was Super Smash Brothers Ultimate was coming out that year. So, but I don't remember what the booth was. It might have been Link's Awakening, actually. It might have been that footage that Red was running.
You
on
were
the video.
That, yeah.
We actually have a wiki on IGN where we highlight all the games that were shown each year.
Yeah, that
Doom
Link's
Eternal,
Awakening.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Man, that was a fun time. Well, we're going to stop talking about big gaming events, and we're going to start talking on a little more focused indie game event. Anyone here familiar with a little show called Rogue Jam Pair? Have you heard of this program?
I've heard of this thing, yeah. What are we talking about? That show is over.
Well, we're talking about the Audience Award, which went to a game called Misplaced, which I was mistakenly Misplaced, yeah, until I watched the video
about
it. They
brought that up on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And oh my God, I just did it. Misplaced.
It's because it sounds like MySpace, right? And
you're yeah, that's like, right. I'm like, expected Tom to be like, looking at you like that. But yeah, this game is Link's Awakening. Funny enough, we were just talking about that. I mean, the Link's Awakening remake on the Switch. This is a very charming, very cute game that wears its inspiration on its sleeve to the point that I thought it would be interesting to talk about. When does a game pass homage and become a clone? Or, you know, I'm not going to say this is a knockoff, but this looks like almost like an expansion to Link's Awakening. And there are some games. Pear, you're laughing.
I'm really curious from Pear's perspective, because I'm sure there was more conversation about this that we did not see in Rogue
Yes.
Jam.
So much.
Please enlighten us.
Yes. Well, I would like to hear the story of this.
So the game, you know, what we played of the game, it feels good. Like, it feels like Link's Awakening. It obviously, the very first area looks like this looks a little different, but like the overall style and everything, it's more than an homage, right? It's very, very close. And so when we first saw this game and played this game, it didn't make it into the overall category for, you know, selection, because we felt it was too derivative. And we had lots of discussions about that in the beginning. We said, well, I don't get it. Like, this is a husband and wife team, right? So they're doing a lot with very little, which is impressive. They clearly loved Link's Awakening. And so for a lot of indie devs or new developers, it's, you know, sometimes they start with replicating something they love. Modders, right, work on games that already exist and bring something new to them. They're fan projects that look exactly like, you know, games that you already know, and sometimes they even use the characters that you know. This is different. The game, there's more to the game than it just being Link's Awakening, but it was very frustrating to me to see the character being a little dude with a shield and a sword. I'm like, take a game like Tunic. Tunic is very much inspired by Link to the Past, right? And like, if you haven't played Tunic, it is my game of the year. I think, Sam, it's still game of the year, right?
It's my game of the year. Yeah.
Wow.
I love that game, but it's like, you play it and the main character is a fox, and it's instantly different. There are differences in style. And like, even though it feels like it opens up and does things that Link to the Past never did, right? Like,
it importantly has its own graphical style for this conversation. I mean,
yes. But like, it still looks like it. This has the same graphical style as Link's Awakening Remake. And like, our first frustration was like, would it have killed you to just make it be set on an alien planet where the trees are blue? Or, you know, it's like, when you put the two side by side, like, does it have to be pots? Like, why do dungeons have pots, right? Like, could it just be crates? I know crates are not original, but like, it's just so close. And during our interview with the developer, I tried to push for this multiple times. And I'm like, what are you doing that is more unique, like that stands out? And obviously, we published some clips from Reggie saying the same thing. And I said specifically, like, what are you doing to make it stand out? Because you've got a sword, a shield, you're pushing spiky things with the shield out of the way, which is very Zelda. And he said, well, right now the hammer is like a key to open things, but I would like to turn the hammer into a weapon and a tool. I'm like, but that's like Zelda again. Like, don't make it a hammer.
There was something else that the developers mentioned that I'm curious about, but he seemed very hesitant to talk about it because it seemed to be a spoiler for the game. And it was something about, God, what was it?
I can tell you. It's the AR aspect, right? Like, yes. There are things that exist outside the game where you go on social media and there's some sort of tie in with an account that ties to this game, or coordinates being given in the in the game tied to something in the real world, which is a little bit more like the meta game in Tunic, where there's life to the game inside the in-game manual, which I thought was really interesting. It wasn't shown in the demo, but all of that to me then, my follow-up question to that would have been like, why does it look like Zelda then? Why doesn't it tie in more with the real world and have that sort of theme? And maybe there is that element underlying, right? Like, maybe there's something underneath. Maybe this isn't the real world and it's simulated. Yeah. But there are glimpses at levels that look different from Link's Awakening. So, you know, take that.
Yeah, it's an isekai where someone in real life, something terrible happens and they get misplaced into their favorite game, right?
There you go,
I'm just like, I'm just assuming, I'm just extrapolating based off of the things that we know about it. But I think the biggest problem that people would see when looking at this game is the art style. I think if the art style didn't so perfectly match Link's Awakening, people wouldn't be as upset about it. Exactly.
And the character.
Tunic.
Yeah.
And the right. character. Yeah, I guess. I mean, there are some pretty bold-faced Zelda likes out there, right? Like, there's a lot of them. And I feel like a lot of times people don't get upset about it. I feel like upset is a strong word. People don't get annoyed at the blatant copy as long as the art style looks different. Like, right. they're like, let's see, like Blossom Tales, Turnip Boy Evades, Tax Evasion. Those are all very, Zelda likes.
3D Dot look, Game Heroes, the best Zelda like of all
I reviewed
time.
That.
They look different.
Blossom Tales looks a lot like Link to the Past, right? The art style is very similar, but then when you see it played in the very first footage you see, you can already see that it is an upgrade. It's almost like, all right, we took Link to the Past and now we're running it on more modern machines, and so there's more particle effects and all of that. Whereas, to be fair, Misplaced looks exactly like Link's Awakening remake, and I think that is one of the issues. But look, I mean, art sometimes is derivative, right? And sometimes you start with something you love, and a replica, in this case, it's not being designed for Switch. It's actually on another platform. You're bringing something to another platform that's not there. And so I am excited for Misplaced based on that, right? Like, there is here is a game that is like revisiting Link to the Past. It's on a different platform, but it also seems to go beyond it. And so I'm really excited for that. But like at the same time, I shared the frustration of people who say like, why isn't the main character something different? Or like if the main character is wearing like this kind of pilot helmet, why isn't there like an aeronautics theme or something to set it apart from the world we already visited? And I totally get that feedback.
Yeah.
I guess thinking more about the story as well. I mean, I don't want to spoil Link's Awakening for anyone, but I guess it's not like that different either. So.
Yeah, there's a hint in the title, right?
Yeah.
About what that game is about. But you know, I think what is there is really impressive from the perspective of who created it, right? Really small team. This is not Nintendo. This is not a giant team that's been making video games for, you know, decades and is well-resourced and has all these, you know, this kind of built-in marketing because of their pedigree. This is an indie developer, and they started with something that they love. And now my hope is that it will be transformative and that we will see this game evolve. And like, I'm happy that it won the audience award. And just to be clear, the audience award was audience members based on trailers picked games that didn't make it into the final category, kind of like a last chance kitchen kind of thing, where you like bring back a game and then we, the judges, play the games and based on how they actually play, pick a winner out of that shortlist. And that's why Misplaced won, because it plays great. It's fun. It's cute. There's great promise here, but yeah, I'd love to see it go beyond its inspiration.
Yeah,
I have some thoughts. One is that I think the more Zelda clones, the better. I think it's like it's a genre, and I love it. And you know, if there's twists on it, that's great. I love that. I think that there's some subtext here which hasn't been mentioned, which is that we Nintendo fans tend to get upset when there's a Nintendo-like game that might not be on a Nintendo platform. And, you know, when there's 3D Dot Game Heroes face this, like, people are like, oh, it's just Zelda being completely copied by Sony, another thing Sony's copying. Like, it just, some people are just not going to give the game a pass for that. They think that all Zelda belongs on Nintendo. And that hasn't been the case for three decades, right? Zelda is a genre. Like, there's a Beyond Oasis on forward. There's incredible games that have come out on other systems that have Zelda-like elements. So, you know, that's just something to take into account. Now, with this game in particular, I think also taking an art style wholesale and making your own game with it gets a pass for many games that people that are listening to this like Shovel Knight. I mean, that game is just it's taking all the elements of Mega Man, just doing a Mega Man game. That's just what it is. And I know there's twists on it. This game has twists too. But like, you can't give one a pass and then give another a pass. Like, that is the case. If somebody made it a game that looked like Octopath Traveler and was better than Octopath Traveler, I would like it more than Octopath Traveler. I don't care that it took the style. The style is incredible, and Octopath Traveler absolutely invented a style that looks really cool. But if there was a game that was as good as Chrono Trigger that looked like that somebody made in their house with their wife, like, or their husband, that's super cool.
Yeah. Right.
I think it's so funny.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Pear, but because I haven't played the game, but I think part of the problem is it's not just that it resembles Link's Awakening. Like, it borrows so much from Link's Awakening back in the day, we didn't have the vocabulary to describe what a first-person shooter was. We called them all Doom clones.
Yeah,
essentially, the gameplay was the same. You were first-person, and you were shooting aliens and space marines and whatnot. But those games, in spite of having the same style of gameplay, were different games. I think
that if this game is actually fun and it's like really unique and feels different, that's great. But if it's too samey and that's a problem with it, like I feel like I'm just playing the same game again, that's a good criticism to make of a game, right? It's like, this is too much like Zelda, so it's kind of boring because I've done this all before. Like that is totally legit.
That was my disappointment with the comment about the hammer. Like right now, the way the hammer functions in the game, it's essentially just a key. When you get to a certain blockage in the path, if you have a hammer, you just hit A and he whips out the hammer and it basically unlocks the passage. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, it's got the hammer. I don't know why they didn't use a completely different item, because the hammer I associate with Zelda, like a sword, every game.
Bombs.
Like this has a sword, right? It's fine, yeah. Right? But it's like, that. Why the hammer? And then the comment was, well, I'm going to make the hammer work more like it does in Zelda. I'm like, no, that's not what I want. I want you to not have a freaking hammer. I want you to do something like, every Zelda game, we get a hook shot or a boomerang, something that we know to use. And the moment we see it, we know how it works. And I want games that expand on Zelda likes or Metroids or all of that. I want them to have their unique weapons and tools where when I get it, I'm like, I wonder what this does, and figure out how to use it rather than going, it's a hammer, it'll hammer down pegs and I can pass, right?
Yeah, the keyhole, and the key is shaped like it. So it's like, okay, now I'm just going to go unlock all the things. It's like the red doors in Metroid. Like, that's not the most creative way to block off an area. It's like, that's for missiles. Like, you just go back and do them. So, like, Metroid got really creative with that eventually. It's like, traversal becomes unique, and you're like, oh, now I can get really high in rooms because I can swing on this, like, grapple hook. Like, that type of stuff is what it's totally about.
Yeah, and then obviously for Rogue Jam, and if you're listening to this, you haven't watched the show, give it a shot. I'm a judge on the show. Reggie's on it. We've got a talented team from folks from Netflix and Warner Brothers helping judge. And the whole point was to find indies that might need additional resourcing, paired with Rogue, the game publisher that's run by Matt Casamassina, who used to be the editor of Nintendo at IGN and is really passionate about indie games and Nintendo games as well. And then figure out, like, can we reward the clever ones, the ones that show the most promise gameplay-wise, with cash prizes? And this game got 50 grand. That's not enough to fund its development. We're seeing a game that is very, very early on in development still. And, the development team is, aspirationally, I think they want to spend, significantly more time on the game and raise more money to get it to completion. And so what you're seeing is something, very, very early on, and hopefully will evolve over time too. Hey, per your point, Sam, on like games that look like others and, Octopath Traveler, a day ago, we posted a trailer of a game called Code.
Thank you for
Codename Wandering Sword.
Yeah, and that it's using that style.
And it doesn't only look like Octopath Traveler, it looks like the Live Alive remake that is using the style of Octopath Traveler, right? Yeah. It's like Octopath kind of created this unique look of where you take games and it looks a little bit like the old Saga games, a little bit like Final Fantasy.
It's like
and
pixels,
3D-izes them.
3D-ized with a diorama and a motion blur. Like that's like what's going on in these games.
And so this code name, Wandering Sword, the reason why I'm not mad at it is first of all, I love this style. And right now, the more games look like this, the better. Look how cool that looks.
Heck
already,
yeah.
Right?
It's beautiful.
And it's set in the, it's a wuxia style game. So it uses martial arts and it's set in, it's a completely different setting. Live Alive has, you know, obviously China and Japan stages in it, obviously, he says.
But, the only but this person game that's is completely on our entire staffs is obviously.
No, but like this game is set in China and it's something that we don't see this often. And so it doesn't feel like Octopath Traveler. And that is my hope for Misplaced, yeah. is that the more we see of it, the more it's not going to be Ice World, but something different that we're discovering.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yep. I'm interested to see how it turns out. And I do hope that they pare down the inspiration a little bit. Well, P-A-R-E.
Pare down. So,
Before we move on, I just want to say that I noticed almost a blatant ripoff in one of my favorite game series, which is Metal Gear Solid. I watched the movie Speed, which is also known as the bus that couldn't slow down. Yep. And the music in that movie is almost exactly the same as in Metal Gear. The dun, 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 dun. Oh. That is all the music in the movie Speed, which, by the way, that movie is so good. I've forgotten how amazing it is.
There's a big Tucson tie-in to that, Seth.
I did not know that.
Yeah, the Wildcat stuff. She's from University of Arizona, and he calls her Wildcat.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that scene that we just saw, if you're watching the video, of the car just jumping into the frame, that is how you're introduced to the main characters. Like, they just literally jump a hill into the frame, and that is how you know that Speed is amazing. But the Metal Gear Solid music is in Speed to the point where I thought I was going crazy.
Wow, look how old all the cars look.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What? That movie's 1994, I think is when that came out. Keanu's like just like this little baby face, yeah. and Sandra Bullock mm-hmm. looks exactly the same. Yep. Good for her,
yep.
by the way. All right, I had a Seth soapbox, but I'm just going to go right by because we want to talk about the top reasons we love the Nintendo GameCube. And this week, we're going to be talking about something that makes it so amazing, and that is it is named after exactly what it is. The Xbox is not an X, nor is it a box. The PlayStation, a station, like, for what? Like a train? No, I don't think so. But the GameCube is a cube that plays games. And who doesn't love something that's named literally? It's like a forklift lifting a crate of forks. That's a Mitch Hedberg joke, so I'm going to give him credit for that. But also, I love a little Mitch handle Hedberg. There in case you want to take it along with you. No one ever. Go ahead, Casey.
It's so you can gut it when you're done with it and use it as a lunchbox.
Is that what it is?
I mean, I had friends who actually used GameCubes as lunchboxes in high school, but
that is
seems like a lot of work.
Oh yeah, absolutely, 100%. I don't know.
The handle is so hilarious.
Lunchbox in town.
The handle is you know, somebody they came up with this really unique design principle for the GameCube, and I love the design now. I think it is not very functional for a game console, and back then, you know, depending on what kind of setup you had in your living room, the GameCube was very disruptive because it didn't fit into a normal credenza. But what it was it was almost like going back to your childhood where a video game console is sitting on the carpet in front of the media, the TV, right? TVs used to be big and not hang on walls with everything beautifully stowed away underneath. It's like the console was on the floor on the carpet with the wires running across and you sitting on the floor because the controller cables were too short, which they were on GameCube too. And then sometimes you have to put it away because mom and dad said, clear that out, and you can grab it by the handle and move it. And like for that sort of nostalgia feel, like that design was just exactly the right thing. Now, when it was shown in purple, I said, oh, that's a big mistake. Americans are not going to love the purple box because it now looks like a toy at the time where everybody was talking about game consoles as like these powerful consumer electronics machines. And, you know, NOA obviously reacted to it by releasing wanting to release a black version at launch for this market as well. But like, it's such a unique, cool idea, I think.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a Panasonic version of the GameCube that has a DVD player in it. What's it called?
The Panasonic Q.
Yeah, Panasonic Cube. Yeah, so still right on the nose. And that is a little taller, it's a little shinier, and still has a handle.
It's much bigger. It's quite a bit taller. The handle are two bars on top that run like parallel rather than the one handle the GameCube has.
Like a Gateway PC or something when they had those kind of handles all over.
It's got a chrome faceplate and everything. I love that thing. I own one. And
I think it's probably around you in the office there, unless you took it home.
It's somewhere. But it's a weird device in that it isn't a perfect merging of two technologies. It's not really a GameCube thing that plays DVDs. It's more like a GameCube and a DVD player are housed in the same device.
So it has two trays? Is that how it works?
It has one tray, but the outputs in some cases are distinct. Like it has a digital, it has an optical out, which the GameCube didn't have, but it won't work for the GameCube. It's just weird. It's like weird stuff. Like it couldn't do Dolby Digital, for example, even though the DVDs could do Dolby Digital.
So, So, and look at the little digital display at top. So there's that form factor. There's the black GameCube, the purple GameCube. What other variations of the GameCube casing hardware were there?
There was an orange
So they did a full orange one. But where's
the silver one?
Gold. Silver,
And then there was a gold one for what tie-in? Did that exist for something?
Oh, no, there was a silver one for Metal Gear, right? Wasn't there one for Metal Gear?
So there's two test machines, and one is a teal
green
and then the other is gold. I think that's the gold one, is that there's a recording and a playing one, and we used to get them both through the office. Love those.
Cool. Yeah, the orange one was the boldest
spice
color choice
orange.
That differed. No, silver one was just a regular one, but there was a Metal Gear one. Fran had a
I can picture the Metal Gear GameCube box on Fran's desk.
Yeah.
It was a
Twin Snakes.
Black and purple.
Yep.
Oh, it was
with the gray front,
the
right?
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the little I have one issue with the GameCube, it wasn't a perfect cube because
it's a little oblong.
And bowed out a little bit.
And if you add the Game Boy Player, then it's just a rectangular prism.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I believe that's what you call a rectangle in 3D space.
Oh, the Twin Snakes cube had a
geometry. Serves me correctly.
The Twin Snakes GameCube was silver and had the decal on the tray.
You know, in Canada, they say decal.
Decal,
really?
For decal, I learned that from CJ.
Isn't that part of...
No, it's true. It's true. The NVC listeners in Canada will confirm
Canada, hit us up.
They also don't have Cliff's notes. They have a completely different person that writes notes.
Really? What's wrong with Cliff? What did he do to the Canadians?
I don't know. They claim that they were cheating on tests first.
I knew Brisket had a decal. When you have smoked meats, it has a decal.
Oh, it is. There's the box that Fran had. Great looking system.
That is so cool. All right. Well, that's what we love about the GameCube this week. Well, okay. Look, I just wanted to do a goof a little bit where I talked about how it was named literally, and I appreciate that because no other console has been since or before. So, real quick, what have we been playing? Pear, what you been playing?
Oh, man, I have not been playing a lot of Nintendo games because my wife is traveling, so this is the time to play games that annoy her, like Horizon and other things. No, I was playing a little bit more Pokey and Rocky, but I also am playing this new game that's coming out on June 2nd called Card Shark. Have you heard about it? Okay, it's for Switch, and it's coming out on Steam as well. It's from Nerial, and Nerial made Reigns. Do you remember there was a Game of Thrones version of Reigns too? It was this mobile card game where you're basically you're swiping cards. This game looks like a card game, but it's actually not a card game. It's a card cheating game.
Yes.
So this is it's an adventure game, and it has this really kind of cool art style. If you're watching it, you can see this right now, like almost like shadow puppets. And it's a story-driven game where you're playing as a mute waiter in this tavern in 18th century France, and you get recruited to travel around with this shyster, basically, like this card trickster, and he teaches you all these different techniques, like from pouring the wine for someone and looking over their shoulder to read their cards, to, you know, different tricks on how to serve the best cards to a certain person at the table. And it's used via like button presses and stick gestures and all of that stuff. So it's a really, really different, clever game. And if you just watched the video and thought it was a card playing game, it is not. Devolver is
publishing
this.
In England, it's called Card Sharp.
What?
Nobody cares. I just made a little joke.
Oh, this was... Dude, I swear.
It was a floor guy moment.
Floor guy loved it, but none of us know what you're talking about. But
Sharp is what they call it in the UK. Anyway.
Oh, I see. Okay. Very nice.
No, it wasn't. No. Thank you, Lope.
No, I'm just being nice to you is what I'm saying.
Appreciate it.
No, it's I have to play way more of it. I'm just at the beginning. I want to see how it holds up. But so far, it's one of those cool little games that wasn't on my radar. And then you start playing it, and you're like, this is what Switch is all about. I love these games. Pocket Card Jockey being the other one that we need on the Switch. Of course, we talked about that.
Please
last week.
Bring it over.
Yeah. So I'm playing that.
Very cool, Casey. What have you been up to?
So I actually went back to Ocarina of Time again yesterday.
On the
nice.
Nintendo Switch Online?
Or on the original? Online.
Okay.
Yeah, on the Nintendo Switch Online.
Very cool.
Just some nice comfort food gaming. That game still holds up. I don't care what anyone says, even if the graphics aren't the best, obviously, but it's still very, very fun and works very well. But I don't know. Maybe that's just me memorizing everything that I have to do. So I will never get to re-experience that game.
Did you notice? Did you notice they fixed some of the graphics in emulation? Like the fog is now more pronounced in the beginning and all that?
It's a little better.
Yeah. Yep. They tweaked it.
I did not play it before
they
implemented some of the fixes, so I'm not sure.
Gotcha.
But it's still good. Also still playing Monster Hunter Rise. There's still event quests and things that I didn't finish.
What a shocker.
I know. Sunbreak is coming out in a month. I got to remember how to not suck. It's very important to not suck in that game.
Yeah.
And I've also been playing Ark Survival Evolved, which is available on the Switch, but do not play it on the Switch. It was released and then never updated and never touched and optimized.
Ouch.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But that's a very fun game, but it is Nintendo, so I won't talk about it anymore.
All right. Sam, what have you been playing lately?
I am deep in the clutches of Spiritfarer. I enjoy that game. It has... all of the qualities that I look for in a game about exploration. It has this kind of Wind Waker-esque.
We lost Sam.
We lost Sam.
Okay, I was wondering, I'm like, man, is this me?
No, I was checking too.
All right, well.
Sorry, folks.
While we wait for Sam to come back, I'll just talk about what I've been playing. I, as you know, got a new CRT TV from actually a listener whose family has a house in Maine. I was like, hey, we're going to throw out this CRT. If you want to come get it, here's the address. My parents will be up there this weekend. So I drove out to the middle of like a blueberry field in Maine, wondering, you know, am I going to come back or not?
Why specifically a blueberry field?
Maine has wild blueberries everywhere. And this person's house was in a blueberry field. And he said it was the last house at the end of the road, and it sounded very ominous now. But they were like super nice people, and they gave me this amazing 19-inch CRT TV. So shout out to listener Chris Staples. I really appreciate it. So I've been playing Illusion of Gaia on my original. Look at that.
Nice. Yeah. It looks
so
great.
Fancy.
Oh, I love it. It is so good. It's a Daewoo, which I know that they made very unpopular automobiles in the United States, but I did not know that they were a consumer electronics maker. This thing looks so very good. Apparently he played hundreds of hours of Phantasy Star Online. But anyway, I've been playing Illusion of Gaia on my original Super Nintendo. I never played that game before, and I bought it on eBay for, you know, $30 or $40 and plugged it in, and that's a very fun game. It looks very nice. It's not what I was hoping for, which is a turn-based RPG. I guess I could have like read something about it before I bought it.
No, not possible.
No, yeah, exactly. But I'm enjoying it nonetheless.
Are you using
a
strategy guide?
Playing Super Nintendo. No, I haven't gotten to where I would need one yet, but I eventually will.
Yeah, I thought it would be kind of impenetrable.
No. I mean, I'm very early on into it. And I'm happy to say, and this is the case on all of my old games, all the batteries still work.
Great.
Wow.
Knock on wood. Yeah. So
easy to replace, you know, if there's an issue.
My OG. That is true. But it's just kind of amazing that the 35-year-old copy of The Legend of Zelda that I have still has battery enough to save games to it. Other than that, what's up there?
No, I was going to say, it's really cool that you're playing Illusion of Gaia. If you haven't, I'm assuming you've played other games by Quintet. That's the Japanese developer that made it. They made ActRaiser, obviously, ActRaiser 2. But they made one of my kind of hidden gem games, Soul Blazer. You ever play that one?
I have not played that one.
And then, you know, there's also Terra Enigma. So they were really good at making games that looked a little bit more like classic 16-bit RPGs, but still played a little bit more like a Legend of Zelda or Secret of Mana game.
Okay. I'll have to check those out. But yeah, other than that, all I've been playing is Microsoft Flight Simulator. Who would have thought? The Maverick expansion is out. I'm going to learn how to land on a aircraft carrier, which was impossible in the original Top Gun.
Yes, it was.
Yes, because there were some controller issues things there.
It's like learning how to surf in TNC Surf Design. It's just impossible. Yeah, I
also a very bad game that every kid I knew had a copy of.
I love that game. I mean, I love it. It's bad. I agree it's bad, but I do love it.
Oh, okay.
I think the skating is really fun, and I learned how to surf once in the IGN offices, and I played it, and it was great. Once you knew how. Yeah, should I continue from the beginning of my Spiritfarer?
Yes. Why? Yeah, why do you love it?
Okay, so I was led to believe this was more of a resource management game and a city building game, right? But it's not. It's also an exploration game. And the exploration is fantastic in it. You have a really cool world that's so much bigger than it lets on at the beginning to explore in 2D. It feels, it has upgrades that are Castlevania-like. You get double jumps and floats and stuff like that. So you start getting around and getting to new areas you return to. So there's a little bit of a Metroid-like stuff going on. It is so good. And then on top of all of that, there is a incredible resource management game and a city building game. And on top of all of that, it's really well written. It just has like awesome like little plot points and dialogue that usually I can't stand in games because it's not written well. This game's written very well, and there's like really cool little character attachments that happen, and it's just I can't believe how much is in this game and how much I was missing not playing it for years. And it is absolutely like a top 10 Switch game for me. Like,
I need to play this game.
Play the crap out of this game. If you have a summer game lull, I can't stop thinking about it. I've been playing it for weeks, like 2.5 weeks, like as much as I can between the mini Star Trek series I have to watch now.
That's really cool. Once again, that was Spiritfarer. Just as a reminder, if you missed any of the game titles that we talked about, just go to ign.com/playlist, and we have a full playlist of all the games being talked about in our podcasts, and you can, you know, add them to your two playlist or to your collection if you've already played them or finished them. So please do that, and if you miss anything, that's the place to find them.
I also made a playlist that we're going to feature this weekend, where you can find those, the kind of featured playlist page of my favorite NES games, which I ranked not by quality alone, but also by, you know, goofiness and something, stuff that's worth checking out. I always tell people I collect based on rarity, quality, and irony. Like, those are three things that I value. And there's games like Zombie Nightmare, which I think meet all three of those. Check it out.
I'm looking at your list right now. According to IGN, it says it takes 105 hours to beat those games.
Yes. Can you imagine that time investment? See, Monster Party's in there, right? Nobody in their right mind would recommend Monster Party as the first game for people to get. And Family Feud, I love that as a party game. It is so fun guessing what people thought was a Hollywood hunk in 1988. I just have no point of reference for this, and it's great.
Well, obviously, it's Tom Selleck. TV's Magnum PI. Yeah,
it's like Scott Baio and stuff. It's weird.
That's great. You've got the Japanese Goonies on there.
Yeah, so the Goonies 1, which I can't recommend highly enough. It's in the PlayChoice machines in the United States, but, you know, in Japan it came out and some other iterations versus stuff like that. But yeah, it's a great Donkey Kong-like with a little bit more complexity. Very cool. Very different than Goonies 2.
Yeah, the playlists are fun. I actually made one of every game that I've reviewed at IGN. I've reviewed 34 games at IGN, which
that's crazy, actually,
to be astonishing. Yeah, I like I said on Twitter, it's one of my favorite parts of the job, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was going through and I was like, dang. And then it turned out some of them were for Seth Macy and some of them were Seth G. Macy.
Yeah.
So they're not in order because I had to add like five of them at the end.
Yeah, we can reconcile that for you too. But that's cool that you made that list. That. I should do that.
That's yeah, a good idea. I made another one, but I can't remember. Oh, no, I made retro games that are within arm's reach at this exact moment. What a stupid waste of time. But it's probably still true, even though I've rearranged my office. All right. We're going to talk a question block. Actually, one of the question blocks is what was by Jonathan Kratz was what are some tips for folks who are getting started with vintage Nintendo game systems collecting? And I think Sam's advice right there to go the three criteria, what is it? Rarity,
quality, and irony. And yeah, because there's good games. There's rare games, which are going to be harder to find, and then stupid games.
Yeah, I've been finding that a lot of fun games are priced pretty reasonably. It's generally the very famous ones, Chrono Trigger, Super Metroid, Complete in Box. Like those that are very good games are also pretty expensive. And then it's like the really rare ones, like Dracula X, which isn't that great of a game.
But
it's also, that's a very valuable Super NES.
Mega Man X3. Right, there's a couple like that. Ogre Battle.
Yeah.
I would also recommend if you live in the right area and you have flea markets and garage sales and antique malls, do that. Do not do it online. There's an economy. It's way, way inflated. I think it might be, these go up and down. I've been collecting for a long time. It's been on an upswing for way long right now. It could crash
it's
out.
Too long.
Wait for that. But
overvalued.
Like,
it will. Yeah, exactly. Casey's right. Yeah, and another thing,
and
about
people rip you off too. There's some fake games out there.
Oh yeah. I bought a fake copy of Final Fantasy VI. It was not disclosed in the eBay setting, and I put it online, and Stealth 40K was like, "Oh, you bought a fake, dude." I was like,
"Yeah,
so, I did too." Yeah. I bought Zelda's Adventure for the CDI many years ago, and it was an obvious copy.
That was
too.
Fake. Oh no, because you could just
fake,
burn those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you should really burn that game anyway, but
yeah, right.
Yeah.
Literally,
so bad.
So,
different version of burn.
This is a quick one because we're almost out of time, but Evan Bidoof, or I guess Bidoof.
It's a Pokemon.
What does Bidoof evolve into?
The barrel.
The barrel?
Casey, right. That's why you're on. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That was amazing.
That's great.
This is Evan wants to know, what other hobbies do each of you have besides video games? And I was thinking about this and complaining about video games online. That's my other hobby. So, Pear, what are your other hobbies?
Well, I have a family and dogs. I've got two big greyhounds. So I guess that's a hobby. And having a family is a hobby too, and a full-time job. No, I love cooking. And I love books. You know, you've seen when I podcast from my home, you've seen some of the books in the background, and I collect really nice books, some old books from the 1800s as well.
Oh, wow.
Cooking is the big one.
All right. Casey, what about you?
Well, I have chickens, which are really nice. And,
heck yeah.
I love them. They're very fun. Excuse to go sit outside for a while and watch them be silly.
Heck around.
Very... I don't know, stereotypical. I also watch anime, TV shows. I also really like researching things on the internet for like 6 hours and not doing anything else till I get to a point where I'm confident I can do whatever thing I was researching and then never do it.
I
really like that.
That is amazing and very relatable. Sam, what about you?
I own and operate a lot of arcade machines and pinball machines. I spend a lot of time at an arcade in the Bay Area called Free Gold Watch, which we operate something like 20 at a time there. So there's a lot to upkeep and repair. I am an obsessive record collector of certain eras. I probably spend... I don't know. I have a circuit of three or four record stores I go to multiple times a week. I do a lot of online sourcing of records in the 60s and 70s punk genre, mainly. And then I like, you know, a lot of vintage music. So they do that. I do a lot of other types of repair, and I'm really interested in tube amplifiers. I do a lot of stuff with that. I've been in bands for years. My band's tour a lot. We mainly now try to take advantage of we get invited to play out of the country. We're doing some European stuff coming up soon.
Oh, cool.
So that's exciting. And then I'm also involved in a lot of like local music scene stuff. There's a festival this summer called Mosswood Meltdown that I'm on the do a lot of help with and make sure that happens, where we get big stars like Iggy Pop and Bikini Kill this summer, which is really exciting.
Wow.
and stuff like that. So we do a lot of that, and I'm heavily involved there. But it's basically infinite hobbies all the way down. So when I it's very relaxing for me to find time to play retro games and new games, because it's a busy life here in the Bay. I love it, though.
I really miss local music. I used to be very involved in local music scenes, and just like I don't know how to do it anymore.
Oh, wow. I said that complaining about video games was my hobby. That's not really my hobby. My hobby is kind of stupid. I go to thrift stores and I try to find treasures, and failing that, I just find something interesting. Like, I just started collecting VHS cassettes for whatever the hell the reason.
I love art on VHS. I just went to a friend's house who's a bit major VHS pulp collector, and I just looked through so much amazing art. It was incredible.
It is really, and I got into this just at the worst possible time, because thrift stores are not carrying, they will not accept VHSs.
Yeah, they'll throw them away.
They'll tell you to throw them away. So it's like, now, thankfully, it's yard sale season. So I actually got a copy of Close Encounters of the Third Kind that was never opened. And it was $34.95 in whatever, 1984, when it came out. With inflation, that's like a $90 investment that this person never ever opened and watched. So like, my hobby is just collecting really dumb things that annoy my wife. Like, she was like, what did you spend $70 on eBay for? And I was like, I don't know, that must have been a hacker or something. It's certainly not a set of 9 vintage pewter wizards and knights that they used to sell at Hallmark that I always wanted when I was a kid. So there it is.
That's so cool that you can source those.
Oh, there's a whole market. Yeah. I am very excited to get
that. I too like junk shopping. And Seth, if you're ever out in the Bay Area, I can take you to some of the amazing fleas. Because there's not a lot of thrift and antique stores and stuff like that in San Francisco anymore, just because of space and stuff like that. So when I go to the Midwest or something like that, that's when I go nuts.
Oh, yeah. I like to go like to towns that I know there's no colleges nearby, because they have the best stuff, because they haven't been picked over.
Yeah.
And especially if if there's a lot of pickup trucks that look a little menacing, then the college kids don't go there. And then I could swoop in my own.
Yeah. Rural thrift stores are amazing where I go to.
Yep. And they've got great prices.
For games too. There's games. I mean, like, sometimes I just ask, I'll be like, hey, do you have any video games? Be like, oh yeah, there's a box. And they'll be behind the counter sometimes. It's like, they're still like $1 a piece, you know?
Oh my God.
That's a pro tip for collectors out there.
Yeah. Don't let it get out there publicly. Don't let Gary Vee find out about it. He's going to ruin it for everybody. But anyway, that's all the time we have left for this week's NVC. Follow us on Twitter at NVC Podcast. Submit your question block questions on the NVC Facebook group. Thank you, Sam. And thank you, Casey, for showing up. Casey, thank you for premiering your new hair on NVC this week. It is absolutely amazing. I want to thank Red on the ones and twos. And most of all, I want to thank you for hanging out with us. Remember, NVC is the only place where you can
get the thing.
Ah, indeed.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.